Hinshaw Insurance Law Radio is on the air. From Los Angeles, I'm Royal Oaks of ABC News and the law firm of Hinshaw & Culbertson, LLP, inviting you to join us for Hinshaw Law Radio. This program features prominent lawyers and insurance industry professionals discussing insurance and reinsurance cases, issues, and developments. Before we get started, a reminder that the information on Insurance Law Radio is provided for general information purposes only. Nothing stated in the program constitutes legal advice or creates any attorney-client relationship. You should consult directly with an attorney of your choosing if you wish to obtain any advice with respect to any claim or matter. Any views expressed are those of the guests and are not necessarily the views of Hinshaw & Culbertson, LLP, or any of its clients. And now we go to Chicago and your host for Insurance Law Radio, the co-chair of Hinshaw & Culbertson's National Insurance Services Practice Group, Scott Seaman.
Thank you, Royal Oaks, and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Hinshaw's Insurance Law Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. A quick reminder that we have multiple episodes of Insurance Law Radio available on demand. Once we release an episode, you can listen to it at your convenience by going to the Hinshaw Insurance Law Radio page at blogtalkradio.com, or you can visit hinshawlaw.com. Go to the insurance and reinsurance page and click on multimedia, and you'll see all of the episodes there. While 2017 was a year in which judges across the country put their imprimatur on insurance law jurisprudence, and among all of the vast forest of cases over the past year, there actually were several significant court decisions. And we're going to kick off this initial broadcast of 2018 by discussing some of the key insurance coverage decisions from 2017. And we are pleased to be joined by Jeff Sistruck, who is an old friend of this program. Jeff is the senior insurance law reporter for Law 360, and he does a fabulous job covering the insurance law beat and has his pulse on the important and even the not-so-important insurance decisions and regulatory developments. So we're going to be discussing some of the cases that he identified in his article, Biggest Insurance Decisions of 2017, and it was published around December 8th in Law 360. And depending upon our time, we will also add a case or two that I've added to the list. So, Jeff, Happy New Year, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Scott. I'm glad to be here.
So let's get right into the biggest five insurance decisions of 2017. And the first case that you had on your list is the Washington Supreme Court's April 27th decision in the Pro Builder Specialty Insurance case. I would give my one-liner on it as a case where the Washington Supreme Court demonstrated its contempt for the absolute pollution exclusion. But if you could, Jeff, give us your take on the case, the holding, and its significance.
Sure. So this decision stood out to me because it presented a somewhat novel take on the absolute pollution exclusion as viewed through the lens of what's called the efficient proximate cause doctrine. Basically, what the Washington Supreme Court said here, and if I'm remembering right, they were the first state Supreme Court to apply the efficient proximate cause doctrine in this context, was that even given the presence of the absolute pollution exclusion, as applied to the facts of the case that they were called on to decide, which involved injury claims that arose from pool heater. Basically, the justices said that the pollution exclusion on its face applies to the gas that leaked from the heater, but because the proximate cause of the injury was the negligence of the company that installed the heater, that the pollution exclusion therefore wouldn't apply. And this stood out to me and a lot of insurance practitioners because, as I said, it marked the first time the efficient proximate cause doctrine had been applied to a pollution exclusion to eliminate its application. And as you can imagine, policyholder attorneys were really pleased with the decision, and it's popped up, and has been cited in several cases since then involving the pollution exclusion to varying effect. And on the other side of the bar, attorneys who represent insurance companies have said that it's a misapplication of the efficient proximate cause concept.
Really a first-party insurance doctrine that has not before and hopefully will not since be applied to the absolute pollution exclusion.
Right, in the third-party liability context. So it remains to be seen whether other courts of appeal or state Supreme Courts will follow the pro-builders analysis, but none have done so thus far. So it's something to watch in 2018.
Absolutely. So let's travel a little bit east and go to the September 28th decision of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court in Rentkowski versus Washington National Insurance Company. And Jeff, this is the first time really that the Pennsylvania High Court has weighed in on the elements of statutory bad faith, which is Section 8371 under the Pennsylvania statutes. And just by way of background for our listeners, Section 8371 provides that if the court finds that the insurer has acted in bad faith toward the insured, the court may take all of the following actions. And the actions that it may take are awarding interest at a prime rate plus 3%, awarding punitive damages, and assessing costs and attorney's fees against the insurer. But the statute does not define bad faith. It doesn't set forth what the elements of bad faith are. But with the background on the statute, Jeff, what does the Pennsylvania Supreme Court have to say about bad faith and the elements a policyholder must establish?
Yeah, so this is a decision, and this theme will come up again, that was marked almost more by what it didn't do as by what it did. So basically, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court found that based on its prior precedent and the language of 8371, that there's no requirement of that a policyholder prove that an insurance carrier acted with subjective ill will or ill intent. And what that means in practice is there's no need to show that, for example, an insurance company had some internal communications with one of its claims handlers in which it expressed an unfounded basis to deny coverage for an arbitrary reason. So it's a decision that didn't, by all accounts, change the landscape of bad faith law in Pennsylvania, but it provided much-needed guidance and clarified that it's not necessary for an insured to show that third prong of ill will or malicious intent. So it's another case that will be interesting to see in 2018 how lower courts in Pennsylvania and federal courts applying Pennsylvania law will interpret the new guidance and how they'll decide bad faith cases going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say even though the court did not adopt that third element of ill will that the insurer advocated, even in the wake of Rentkowski being correct, or being rather incorrect in denying policy benefits, is not tantamount to bad faith. The insurer must have acted unreasonably. Mere negligence is not enough. and that the policyholder still has to prove the elements by clear and convincing evidence. And I would suggest that in many cases, to satisfy its burden of proof, the policyholder may still often need to offer compelling evidence of the insurer's ill state of mind or improper conduct to establish conduct that at least amounts to recklessness. To me, the most problematic part of the opinion is that the two-part test that the court adopted, sans the showing of self-interest or ill will, can be read to apply to awards of punitive damages. And if that's the case, of course, the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania did not, in this decision, analyze due process or other constitutional requirements to obtain and to sustain a punitive award. And I question whether this test is enough to satisfy the reprehensibility standard of the U.S. Supreme Court needed to sustain a punitive award. And insurers should be careful in the appropriate cases to plead, to argue, and to preserve the appropriate constitutional issues under the federal constitution as well as a state constitution wherever punitive damages are sought. And so now let's head to the great Southland and the South Carolina Supreme Court's January 11, 2017 decision in Harleysville Group Insurance versus Heritage Communities. That was case number 3 on your hit list of big cases. And why don't you tell us about the case and its significance, Jeff?
Sure. So this was a case that had a lot of moving parts in it. It was a construction defect coverage case. And the decision issued early last year by the South Carolina Supreme Court touched on a lot of things, including allocation and the like. Perhaps the most publicized part of the decision was the court's analysis of what constitutes a sufficient reservation of rights letter. And a lot of practitioners on both sides of the insurance bar have pointed to Harleysville, since it was decided, as a solid precedent to establish what an insurance company should and shouldn't do when it comes to issuing a reservation of rights letter. And in essence, what the South Carolina Supreme Court said was that in order for an insurer to later be able to point to its reservation of rights letter in a coverage dispute, and rely upon it, they need to provide a detailed analysis of the claim that was submitted and give the policyholder notice of why it's denying coverage. In this case, the insurance company provided what the court characterized as bare bones or sort of kitchen sink reservation of rights letter, where they provided all sorts of vague general grounds for denying coverage, but didn't specify what in particular about the claim at hand had led it to deny coverage. So, it was a decision, like I said, it had a lot going on in it, but what practitioners have consistently pointed to in the months since it was decided was the guidance on how reservation of rights letters should be composed in order for insurers to preserve their coverage defenses.
I think you hit the nail on the head, and certainly all of the publicity of the case was associated with the rulings with respect to reservation of rights and waivers. And this decision is yet another reminder to insurers defending under a reservation of rights to connect the dots between the policy language and how that language may apply to the specific claims so that the policyholder receives fair notice of the bases upon which the insurer may disclaim coverage. And merely quoting policy language or listing issues without connecting them to the particular claim may be ineffective to preserve rights. And I think overall, though, generally insurers and their lawyers are focused on specifying every potential ground so that nothing is being waived. And, of course, that's understandable. But another important consideration in reservation of rights letters is knowing what grounds not to reserve on or when not to reserve rights, because you need an appreciation for when reserving rights in a particular jurisdiction might create a conflict of interest entitling the policyholder to independent counsel. And sometimes the cost of independent counsel to an insurer can prove to be more costly than the right that they purport to reserve, and especially where their right or the ground that they're relying on is something that they're not likely to prevail upon. And the other thing I think generally is that you may be focused at the time on preserving rights, and even though most coverage cases settle, you have to consider the effect that a communication such as a reservation rights letter might have on a judge or a jury. And a kitchen sink, everything possible type reservation letter, if admitted into evidence, could give the policyholder's counsel some fodder in arguing that the insurer was just looking for any potential ground to deny coverage on. The other good point that you made is that, and very few people have in the press anyway, is that the court decision did involve allocation. The South Carolina Supreme Court, with a slight modification, affirmed the special referee's time on the risk allocation of compensatory damages. But also the court is a rare decision in the sense that it addressed allocation of punitive damages. And the court here held that there would be no allocation of punitive damages to periods in which Harleysville did not issue coverage because the reprehensible acts were entirely within the period of time that Harleysville did issue coverage. And the court went out of its way to emphasize it was not creating a bright-line rule that punitive damages may not be subject to a time on the risk allocation, but concluded here there was no argument and no evidence to support any reprehensible acts. And it was those reprehensible acts, of course, that gave rise to the punitive award, but no evidence that they occurred outside the relevant period of time. So a very interesting case from that perspective as well. And let's travel now from state Supreme Courts and cover the Third Circuit's April 21st, 2017 ruling in General Refractories versus First State. This decision addressed the scope of a asbestos-related exclusion. Jeff, correct?
Yeah, so here, this was a case that touching on the same theme that I mentioned earlier, was significant because of what it didn't decide. And what the Third Circuit said was that an asbestos exclusion applied to bar coverage for claims related to asbestos in any form. What the district court had said was that the exclusion applied only to claims related to asbestos in its raw form. So, understandably, the district court's decision set off a lot of alarm bells among insurance companies. And if the Third Circuit had sided with the policyholder here and held that the exclusion was limited to asbestos in its raw form, that could have greatly expanded insurers' exposure to asbestos-related injury claims. But much to the insurance industry's relief, the Third Circuit reversed the lower court, found that the asbestos exclusion applied broadly, and the rest is history. And the insurance industry was able to breathe a sigh of relief.
Yes, and then live to fight another battle. And rounding out your big five is the November 6th California Court of Appeals decision in Travelers versus Activists. This is an opioid coverage action where the court returned to some fundamental principles of liability insurance law to find no coverage. What are your takeaways from this decision, Jeff?
Yeah, so this case added to the growing body of case law on the availability of coverage for these opioid public nuisance cases. So here, the California Court of Appeal declined to find coverage for a series of lawsuits filed by two California municipalities and the city of Chicago against the Actavis and its Watson Pharmaceuticals unit. And the focus of these opioid cases has often been on whether they seek damages due to bodily injury. And what the court basically said here was that given the way that the complaints were structured, that no coverage was available in the first instance, and even if it was, there was an exclusion applicable for claims related to the policyholder's product. And so this was a win for the insurance companies, and as I mentioned, you know, added to the body of case law, you know, on both sides of this issue. And we haven't heard the last of this particular case. The policyholders, Actavis and Watson, have filed a petition for review with the California Supreme Court. And I believe the insurance company's answer to that is due in the next couple months. So it remains to be seen whether the California Supreme Court will have the final say on this.
Well, absolutely. And of course, a lot of other pending opioid coverage cases out there. So a lot of people will be looking to see what happens if anything further in this case. And Jeff, you know, you hit the nail on the head when you identified certainly five of the biggest cases. There's probably a few we could all disagree as to, you know, if we were expanding the list to 10, what we might put on. One case I did want to mention was last month in Global Reinsurance versus Century Indemnity. The New York Court of Appeals answered a certified question from the Second Circuit. The decision really in the minds of ceding companies was a blow to the Belafonte cap that served really as a start of steer-by for many courts over the past quarter of a century. The issue is whether the reinsurance accepted limits of a facultative certificate capped the reinsurer's liability for both loss and expense. And that was squarely presented in the Global Re case. Rather than answer the question for itself, the Second Circuit first certified a question as to whether or not there was a presumption or rule under New York law that the excess insurance versus Factory Mutual case, which followed the Belafonte decision of the Second Circuit, imposed a rule of construction or a strong presumption that the per occurrence liability cap in a facultative reinsurance contract limits the total cap regardless of whether the underlying policy covered or did not cover expenses. So that case is now returning to the Second Circuit. We'll keep a watch on that as the days and months go by. A very interesting case, probably the most significant case of the year from a reinsurance law point of view. And, of course, there are several other key decisions, but these were the ones we thought would have your attention and be of greatest interest to you. So, Jeff, once again, our thanks to you for joining us. Jeff, senior insurance law reporter at Law 360. Keep posted on insurance law by following Jeff and his articles that appear daily in Law 360. Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks again for having me.
And we'd love to hear from you if you have any ideas about topics you would like to hear or guests you'd like to hear from on Hinshaw's Insurance Law Radio, please let us know. This is Scott Seaman thanking you for joining us on Hinshaw's Insurance Law Radio. We look forward to speaking to you soon to address other topics of interest to insurance and reinsurance practitioners, professionals, and decision makers.
You've been listening to Hinshaw & Culbertson LLP's Insurance Law Radio. The information contained in this program is provided solely for general informational purposes and does not constitute legal advice. For information on past and upcoming Insurance Law Radio programs, visit the Insurance Services Practice Group page of www.hinshawlaw.com. This is Royal Oaks thanking you for joining us and inviting you to join us for the next episode of Insurance Law Radio.
At Arizona State University, we've made online education better, smarter, and more personalized so you can go further in your aspiring field.
I decided to pursue medicine once I realized that ASU did have the online program for biological sciences. You're still required to learn the same curriculum. You're still being tested on the same content that anyone would be tested on in person. The comprehensiveness of the program prepared me so well for medical school.
Explore over 300 programs at asuonline.asu.edu.
Morning people wake up for peace and quiet. McDonald's breakfast people, we wake up for the sweet rush of getting that warm, delicious breakfast right before it ends.
Be a McDonald's breakfast person and get a bagel sandwich. Imagine a fluffy egg, two slices of cheese, plus your choice of a steak patty, bacon, or sausage, all on a toasted bagel. Bagels are here at participating McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.